Well, hello, everybody. We are really excited to have you here with us today. My name is Erin Cameron, and I'm the Development and Outreach Coordinator for SACE. I will be your facilitator for today's webinar, 2012 Election Results. On behalf of SACE, I'd like to thank you for attending today's webinar. Your interest and support are very critical to the work that we do. We will be recording this webinar, so all the lines have been muted to assure recording quality. I encourage you to chat in your questions using the questions option on your control panel. We will then answer the questions in the order they are received at the end of the presentation. I also want to add that all material from this presentation will be available on our website, cleanenergy.org. For those of you not familiar with SACE, we are a regional organization focused on promoting responsible energy choices that create global warming solutions and ensure clean, safe, and healthy communities throughout the Southeast. SACE has been a leading voice for energy policy to protect the quality of life and treasured places in the Southeast since 1985. We are a membership organization, and I'd like to thank all of our members on this call and encourage those of you who are not members to please join us today. I'd now like to introduce our speaker, Jennifer Renix. Jennifer Renix directs the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy's federal policy and communication efforts. She serves as the primary liaison between SACE's programs and our region's congressional offices in order to educate policymakers about the challenges our region faces from global warming and the clean energy solutions at hand. An experienced advocate, writer, and public speaker, Jennifer also manages SACE's communication efforts and oversees digital communications for the organization. She earned a Master of Science degree in Environmental Policy and Resource Management from the University of Michigan in 2000, which included a summer of ecological field research in Belize and a Bachelor of Arts from Tufts University in 1993. And now I will turn the presentation over to Jen.
Thank you very much, Erin. I'd like to welcome everyone to our election results webinar. And for those of you who are in swing states, I'd like to welcome you to the end of political ads on every corner. I think we are all ready to move in to the new world. What I'd like to do here on this webinar is spend about 20 minutes quickly going through presidential and congressional results, as well as a couple of state-specific races. And then spend about 20 minutes looking at the implications these elections may have on climate energy work at both the national and the regional level. And then finally, we will leave plenty of time at the end for questions. So unless you have a clarifying question that you want to type into the message box, let's hold questions for that final 20 minutes, and we will address them then. So away we go. Erin, if you can move to the next slide, please. As surely everyone knows by now, what was called the tightest election in decades ended up being actually considerably lopsided in the Electoral College. President Obama did win 303 electoral votes, and Governor Romney won 206. For those of you who are good at math, you'll notice those numbers don't add up to 538. That's the total number of electoral votes. It's because all of the precincts have reported in Florida, but it has not officially been called yet because President Obama leads the state by about 0.6%. That's only about 50,000 votes. And so until they are clear that absentee ballots and other outstanding ballots would not tip the balance, they are not going to call that state. However, Florida's 29 votes obviously would not impact the outcome of the election. And I'm sure everybody's very familiar with this map, this red and blue so-called map. It's not really, I think, the most accurate way to portray popular vote. If you can go to the next slide, then, please, Erin. This is another level map showing another perspective on the votes for the president by counties. And while it is, I think it's more effective in showing how heterogeneous some of the red or blue states really are. In particular, if you look at the Southeast, although many Southeastern states did vote for Governor Romney in the Electoral College, you can see there's actually a decent bit of blue in some of those states, and then likewise a state like California, which did vote for President Obama, has a lot of red too. So if we can move on to the next slide, we will move on to congressional results. Before the election, the United States Senate was 53-47 with Democrats in the majority. And now the composition of the Senate will be 54-45-1. One senator-elect, Angus King of Maine has not indicated which party, if any, he intends to caucus with, whereas Senator Bernie Sanders, he was reelected there in Vermont. You'll see the other slice of green. He has traditionally caucused with the Democrats. So that's how those numbers break down. There were no pickups in the Southeast for either Democrats or Republicans. Bob Corker of Tennessee, Bill Nelson of Florida, Roger Wicker of Mississippi, they were all easily reelected, and a close Senate race in Virginia did go to former Governor Tim Kaine. I'll touch on some of those races again later. Next slide, please. There's our red noting the states of interest there in the Southeast. Next slide. In the United States House of Representatives, before the election, the U.S. House was 242 to 193 with Republicans in the majority. And for the 113th Congress, the composition will actually not change too much. Right now, it is at 233 seats to approximately 193 seats, and there are still 9 races pending. And Aaron, if you can advance the next level, it will show those couple of tight races here in the Southeast. One more. We have a tight race in North Carolina. We have a tight race in Louisiana, if we can do that one. Yep, thank you. And then also a tight race in Florida. And so each of those may possibly, if you can advance one more time, that may possibly affect those final totals. I do want to point out that the Southeast did pick up 4 congressional seats through the reapportionment, 2 of those in Florida and 1 each in South Carolina and Georgia. And this is confirming an electorate transition that is vigorously happening in our region, the influx of newcomers and population growth among current residents. And something I want to flag for all of us who do climate energy work in this region is the Southeast is likely to gain even more seats in future censuses, because population projections suggest our region is going to grow. We are currently at 113 million, and the projections are for 143 million by 2030. That is the fastest growth per region in the U.S., and that would largely be due to Florida, which is projected to gain a 79% increase, which is really spectacular. And we may talk a little bit about shifting demographics before the end of the webinar, if we have time. If you could please move to the next slide, Aaron. So, as I mentioned before, in the 113th Congress, there are 9 House races, so too close to call. But more or less, this is the look of the 113th Congress, as I said before. And I did try to do a little bit of a Southeast breakdown there just to show the relative numbers of representatives and senators from each party in our region. So if you can move to the next slide. Now I'd like to move one by one through the 10 states in the Southeast that our organization covers. So we'll start in Alabama. And Alabama's congressional delegation for the 113th Congress will look pretty much exactly the same as it does now. Every incumbent was comfortably reelected. There was typically only token opposition in the districts. And I just want to note there, a bracket denotes a sitting senator that was not up for re-election this cycle, as those are 6-year terms. So only Alabama's congressional House delegation was sitting for their seats. Now if we can move on to Florida. And this slide is going to be a bit challenging. And if it looks a little unfamiliar to you, it's because many districts in Florida were reconfigured and renumbered as a result of the redistricting from the census. So, for example, District 3 was actually an open seat in a newly created district, whereas Representative Brown, who once represented the 3rd district, she now represents the 5th district. So that's why some of the names and numbers might not match up. And despite these shuffled districts and the existence of the Fair Districts Amendment, that was a voter-approved constitutional amendment in Florida that aimed to ban gerrymandering in how the districts are configured. But despite these, Florida's 2013 congressional delegation really remains pretty much the same. There's just a few notable exceptions here. As I said before, Florida did gain 2 seats as a result of the census. The third district fair was won by political newcomer and veterinarian Ted Yoho. And the other was won, and his name may look familiar, in the ninth district, the outspoken former congressman from Central Florida, Alan Grayson. He lost his first seat to his GOP challenger in 2010 and then regained this new seat in 2012. There'll be another newcomer there, also heading to Washington. That's a change in name, but not a change in party. That's Florida's 6th District, Representative-elect Ron DeSantis. He is a Tea Party candidate who successfully challenged the veteran Congressman Cliff Stearns during the primaries for the 6th District, and he comfortably won election in that conservative-leaning district there in Central Florida. And the fourth and fifth new faces heading to D.C. for Florida are going to come from the southern part of the state. This is a race not yet called, even though I have colored it in. The outspoken, controversial Tea Party favorite Alan West actually shifted from District 22 up to District 18 in an attempt to try and retain his seat, but it appears he has narrowly lost to a political newcomer. He is a 29-year-old man, Patrick Murphy. And as of this morning, November 8th, West has not conceded the race, but the margin is appears to be wide enough to avoid an automatic recount. So it will probably be certified, and we will have Representative-elect Murphy there in the 18th, which is a change in party, as I've noted. And then, even further down the state, in a rematch of their 2010 race, Joe Garcia took on David Rivera, and this time he was successful. He unseated this one-term incumbent, and that was a strong margin of victory, about 10 percentage points. So you can see in Florida, there were two new seats, there were two flip seats, and then there was a primary challenge that resulted in a new congressman. And I did want to note, although some pundits had originally speculated that Bill Nelson might be vulnerable to a Senate challenge, he easily won re-election to the Senate by more than a million votes. It was more than 10 percentage points. And he actually strongly outperformed the president throughout the state. So he will return, and I will touch on implications for him returning later. Aaron, if we could go to the next slide into Georgia. And like Alabama, every incumbent in Georgia was reelected. And what's notable about that is that included Congressman John Barrow. He almost always faces stiff competition from a challenger in what has increasingly become a more and more conservative district in the southeastern part of the state. And as I mentioned before, Georgia also added a new seat as a result of the census. And State Representative Doug Collins easily won that seat. So he represents the newly configured 9th district up in the north. East corner of the state, and otherwise not many changes happening there in Georgia. If you can go to the next slide, Aaron. This is one of the state races that I'm just going to pivot to for just a moment. In Georgia, the public service commissioners are not appointed. They are elected. And this is a race that may have considerable implications for energy policy in Georgia in particular. And both incumbents were reelected, so I just wanted to touch on that. Commissioner Chuck Eaton, he won a second term in the 3rd District, and that largely covers the metro Atlanta area. And in western Georgia, Commissioner Stan Weiss, he won a fourth term for the 5th District. And so I just wanted to point out, I think it's worth noting, all 5 seats on the commission that regulates the state's electric and other utilities, they make decisions worth billions of dollars to both utilities and customers. This commission will continue to be represented entirely by conservatives. All 5 commissioners are Republicans. And a more conservative-leaning commission will likely impact power generation, construction decisions in the state for either high-risk energy sources or for renewables, as well as ratepayer costs, energy efficiency programs, et cetera. So this is something that SACE will continue to track and continue to report through blogs and other outreach that we do. All right, next slide, please. We'll move through the next couple rather quickly because there were very few changes. In Kentucky, moving northward, only one seat changed party, the state's last Blue Dog congressman, and actually one of the remaining Blue Dog congressman in the country, Ben Chandler. He lost his seat in a very tight race to challenger Andy Barr. So that is the one change of party there. If you can move to the next slide, we'll move back southwards to Louisiana. And likewise, Louisiana's incumbents all easily won election on Tuesday. The notable exception is in the third district, there were two incumbents who vied for the same seat because Louisiana lost a House seat in the redistricting process after the census. And so as neither Bustani or Landry got more than 50% of the vote outright, both incumbents will face a runoff on December 8th, but the seat will remain a Republican hold, so there definitely won't be a change in party. And now if we could move next door to Mississippi, please. Next slide. In Mississippi, as I mentioned before, Senator Wicker easily won re-election, as did the rest of the state's delegation. Each incumbent faced only token opposition. And really, in most of these states, opposition garnered between 20 and sometimes as close as 40% of the vote, but there were very few tight races in our region. So Mississippi will also send their same slate of lawmakers back to D.C. next year. If you could go to the next slide, please. In North Carolina, however, there were some fairly significant changes to the state's congressional delegation, so I'll spend a moment here. Partially as a result of a partisan-controlled redistricting process in 2011 after the census, and certainly due to some other factors as well, North Carolina experienced the most significant changes in party control in our region. There are three states that have changed from Democratic to Republican control, and that includes two that were held by Blue Dogs. Larry Kissel represents currently the 8th district near Charlotte, and the retiring Heath Shuler in the 11th district, which covers the western part of the state. And then the 13th district is a newly reconfigured district that put two Democratic incumbents to face off in the 4th district, and so that was a total open seat. There were no incumbents actually running in the 13th district this time. And the one race that is still, you see there, I say final results pending for the North Carolina 7th district, Representative Mike McIntyre, he is an 8-term lawmaker, and his challenger, David Rouser, is down by, as of this morning, it was about 378 votes. It's a very close margin race, and so there may be a recount, and so that is still officially considered an undecided race, but slightly leaning Democrat. So it remains to be seen whether North Carolina will have three changes in party or four changes in party. And then also here in North Carolina, I want to pivot just slightly to the state politics as well. The GOP wave in the North Carolina congressional delegation, it also extended to the governor's race. That was the only governor's race in the Southeast. I haven't ignored the other states. None of them had governors sitting for re-election this year. And in North Carolina, the former mayor of Charlotte, Pat McCrory, he easily defeated the current lieutenant governor, Walter Dalton. So for the first time since Reconstruction, both chambers of North Carolina's General Assembly and the governor's mansion will be held by the GOP. And that may have some implications for state-level energy policies, and I will touch on that towards the very end. Now, if we could advance southwards to South Carolina, like many of our other states in the region, South Carolina saw no changes in its heavily Republican delegation, and there was a new seat gained during the census, and that went to Republican Horry County Council Chairman Tim Rice. So he will join other members of the delegation heading to D.C. next year. And if we could advance to Tennessee, where it is a similar story. There were no closed House races and no seats changed party in Tennessee. And that is interesting despite considerable attention that was focused on the 4th District Representative De Jarlais in the final weeks of the campaign. There were revelations about a past affair, and things got fairly torrid in the headlines, but he was actually fairly comfortably reelected to Congress for that district. And as I noted before, Senator Bob Corker was easily reelected for a second term. Next and final state slide, please. And finally, in Virginia, despite being the most expensive Senate race in the country in the end, the Virginia Senate race wasn't particularly close at the end of the evening. In Virginia, former governor and DNC chairman Tim Kaine bested another former governor and also former U.S. Senator George Allen actually by more than 5 percentage points. And I did just want to flag that that race was the most expensive in the campaign in addition to outside money and money raised and spent by the campaigns. It surpassed $52 million for that single race. But like the rest of our region, there were no tight House races, and so the same slate of congressional representatives will return to Congress. So where that leaves us after a year of campaigning and rhetoric, after a year or two of gridlock and really lack of congressional action, and with, after spending that some say will top $6 billion, I haven't seen all the recent estimates of what the full campaign price tag is. Where we are left is the White House and Congress in 2013 will look remarkably like what we have today. The Congress will remain divided with Democratic control of the upper chamber, with Republican control of the House, and President Obama will remain in the White House. So we have gone around and around in circles and ended up in large part where we began. And now that the ballots are counted and now that people are ready to move on, the next part of this webinar I want to leave a little bit of time to talk about here are what are the implications for climate and energy policy in the months and years ahead. So I'm going to shift us from just numerical-based recaps of numbers and districts to a more subjective and very preliminary look at what we might expect to see. And the big caveat before I jump right into this slide is races are still being decided. It is way too early for predictions and projections. I'm going to call these next slides my 10,000-foot guesses of where we may go and what we hope to see or what we may see. And I definitely encourage everyone to continue looking for a safe blog that will come with more details and then, of course, webinars and blogs that follow. So the re-election implications of the president, a closely divided Congress means sweeping energy reform is unlikely, and I will shift to Congress in a moment. But there is a green light there because I believe that President Obama's re-election gives a green light to a host of pending rules that would hopefully go through in the coming years and suggest that the president is going to continue to rely on EPA's regulatory authority to address climate change by a variety of tools and rules in his toolbox. So I'm starting to touch on a few of them here. EPA's initial efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from new coal-fired power plants under the Clean Air Act is something that may, we hope, come forward and be finalized in 2013. That is that carbon pollution standard as part of the new source performance standard process. Another pending standard that is also related to coal would be final standards for regulating hazardous coal ash. And I do want to point out, although new coal ash standards will not directly curb carbon emissions, stricter regulations on the disposal and storage of toxic coal ash waste will likely lead to a decline in the amount of coal that is burned and will certainly lead to a, we hope, significant increase in water quality and water protections in our region. And so that decline in coal will probably lead to a decline in carbon release. So that is all still to be seen. And I just want to point out here that it's we are 4 years ago next month from the tragic Kingston coal ash disaster. and we're still waiting for these final standards. And the final decision was delayed, obviously, because of the election, but we may also see that in the new year. And then a few other things that we may see, also likely to move forward, some pollution rules to strengthen the national ambient air quality standards for particulate matter. Those are pending, and final action there may also be followed by a revision of the ozone rule that is not pending until 2014, but will have to come up then and may come up before then. And all of these different rules and standards would certainly have implications for energy production and consumption in this country that are separate from congressional legislation. And the final two bullet points there, I'm sure everyone on this call is well aware that climate change was virtually ignored during the campaign by both candidates. And then yet in the final week, climate change sort of roared into the headlines, if you will, with that supercharged Hurricane Sandy that many scientists were quoted on the record as saying it was strengthened by warmer than normal ocean temperatures and the impacts from flooding were aggravated from this immense storm due in part to rising sea levels and expanding thermal expansion of the seas, which creates higher sea levels. So that forced the issue, if you will, onto the table in literally the final days of the campaign. And on Tuesday night, in his victory speech, Obama did directly speak about the issue for the first time in many months. He said, it was a longer quote, but he ended by saying, "We want our children to live in America that isn't threatened by the destructive power of a warming planet." So he didn't come right out and say, "We need laws to reduce carbon pollution," but he definitely referred to it. So it does remain to be seen whether he'll use the bully pulpit to promote legislative action and really try to force Congress to move on this, or whether, as I said before, he'll concentrate on reducing climate pollution through the tools at hand, as I've mentioned above. And then the last bullet there, during his same acceptance speech, in what many have considered a perennial favorite of sitting presidents ever since Richard Nixon first talked about it, President Obama once again referred to the need for America to break its addiction to foreign oil, but he did not provide any specifics. His words, taken at face value, would suggest greater support for measures he has already strongly promoted, increased fuel economy standards, that would lessen all oil use, foreign or domestic. But some could interpret that to mean perhaps he would fully permit the Keystone XL pipeline. That's still foreign oil, but it's Canadian oil, so you could call it North American oil. So we at SAFE, and I'm sure many others, will be watching closely for signs of movement either way on both the oil and the climate action from the president. Next slide, please. And then just a little more technical here with the reelection implications. Given that this is the president's second term, there is not going to be a transitional phase necessary to put key staff and appointments in across the board. But it is expected that some members of the cabinet will leave. I'm waiting for the slide to catch up with me here. and although a lot of the talk, people may have heard, there's been talk about the Departments of State, Treasury, Defense, and Justice, that there may be shuffling at the top with secretaries there. There is also some considerable talk that there may be openings at Departments of Energy, Interior, Transportation, and Agriculture. I'm sorry, that slide is not coming up yet. But those are all listed there. And those departments, certainly more than some of the more widely discussed departments and the secretaries who head them, will certainly impact energy policy through implementation of executive orders, as I said, with the increased fuel economy standards and all that happened there, and also pursuit of departmental programs. So we may see some changes at the top, as I said, of energy, interior, transportation, and agriculture. We may not see notable change. There we go. Thank you. We might not see notable change in the direction that those various departments are going. EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson, I have read, may face pressure from the White House to stay at EPA to avoid what might be a very contentious and difficult Senate confirmation process, though I've heard there are sources expecting her to want to leave. And, you know, given the fact that she spent 2 years being summoned up to Capitol Hill to submit to one grueling hearing after another, it would be hard to blame her for wanting to leave. Obviously, her leadership has been instrumental in getting as many rules to the table as we've seen in the last few years. And as I said, I already referenced several key rules that are still pending and are following. So if Lisa Jackson leads, it will be critical that a very important, very strong leader fills that position. I put just a couple more bullets there about an energy climate team back when the president first won election in 2008. He had an energy climate team. It was headed by former EPA Administrator Carol Browner. There was talk of a climate czar, and that all quietly went away in 2009-2010 for various reasons. There's a wonderful article in The Guardian from the United Kingdom about that. So I put it out there more as a question mark. It's unclear if formal administrative actions will follow now, or again, if he will instead rely on the tools at his disposal. So next slide, and let's look ahead. That was the re-election implications more from the administrative point of view. Now let's look a little bit for a few minutes about looking ahead into the 113th Congress and what some of the legislative implications may be. As I stated before, congressional leadership will remain the same. So there may be some internal shifting on committees, but there will not be significant shifts of leadership on committees or necessarily in chairmanship. We would not expect that House or Senate committees would change direction significantly. So this likely means there is little to no chance, depending on who you poll, that President Obama can resurrect a broad climate bill like was passed in the House in 2009 and then later failed a quiet, slow death in the Senate in 2010. But still, there are some who say, and I've been reading some very interesting commentary, that there will be renewed discussions of a carbon tax when Washington begins to debate, and that may start as soon as next week and the weeks that follow, about the need for new revenue sources, because we are, as you probably are hearing a lot in the news now, we are heading towards a financial fiscal cliff when tax hikes and automatic spending cuts go into effect. And if negotiations don't work, there's certainly going to be a loss of revenue. And so in that time, looking for new revenue sources is going to be very attractive. Taxing the carbon in fossil fuels could conservatively raise, I mean, estimates wildly vary. I've seen $50 billion, I've seen $100 billion a year, but there is significant money there. That goes back to the adage of tax what you burn, not what you earn, perhaps. So there could be some significant tax policy implications there. Time will tell, but I did just want to flag the fact that carbon tax may be the new in as opposed to cap and trade, which was what we heard a few years ago. And then this is something that is very specific to our region, so I definitely wanted to flag it. Another implication is that a staunch foe of offshore drilling is heading back to D.C. In 2010, when the Department of Interior tried to develop a new five-year plan to expand oil and gas leasing and drilling off the coast of Florida and going up the Atlantic coast, Senator Nelson is a vocal and outspoken opponent of offshore drilling. He slowed down the process first by introducing legislation to bar new leasing, and then he thwarted plans to include offshore drilling in the 2010 climate energy bill in the Senate that I referred to earlier. Of course, it wasn't Nelson alone. There was that small thing called the BP oil spill that occurred in April of 2010, and I think that pretty effectively took offshore drilling out of any hopes of a climate energy bill at the same time. But I, for one, am very pleased that Senator Nelson, going back to Washington, is going to keep pressure on not looking at offshore drilling necessarily as a new and viable energy source, but instead perhaps looking at offshore wind or other renewable energy sources that we have in abundance in our region. Next slide, please. So the last slide here about looking ahead to the 113th Congress, this is also sort of inside politics, inside baseball here, but it's worth noting that the Democrats have retained the majority in the Senate, and therefore nuclear expansion may be impacted by the lack of long-term storage solutions for nuclear waste. The Senate Majority Leader is Harry Reid. He is from Nevada, and he is staunchly opposed to a proposal that has long been on the table to make Nevada's Yucca Mountain the national nuclear waste repository. So that certainly keeps that on the table and possibly buries it a little. But something else to watch along the very same lines there is that the Department of Energy, and this specifically may impact us here in the Southeast, the Department of Energy is proposing interim waste storage solutions. If we're not going to ever build or construct Yucca, then what is the question? And interim storage solutions might put Savannah River site, which is there on the South Carolina-Georgia border, right up at the top of the list. So that perhaps would aid nuclear expansion, but it could mean some very questionable and risky outcomes here for our region. I do want to touch on the fact that in addition to a debate on perhaps on a carbon tax, and there are certainly many other energy debates that we may see here in the coming years, another policy that actually is somewhat likely in the new Congress is a federal clean energy standard. And I just want to highlight for you that in January, my colleague Simon Mahan will be doing a webinar specifically on this, how this anticipated legislation could or would change electric generation in our region, and it is quite detailed and in-depth, accompanying a white paper report that he's going to be releasing. So I'm not really going to spend any more time on this, and I welcome you to join us for that webinar when we hopefully will have a little bit more clarity and more direction as well. And the last bullet I have here, and it is bolded and underlined and italicized because hopefully, this won't have anything to do with the 113th Congress, or if it is, it will be a longer-term extension. But the production tax credits and investment tax credits for wind energy development are set to expire on December 31st. And if they do, they will take tens of thousands of jobs with them, potentially, and we have already begun to see layoffs in our region. There was a plant near Sumter, South Carolina, the Caden manufacturing facilities, they have already begun to lay off people. That's just one example that I can think of. And so if these tax credits are not extended before the end of the year, during this next couple weeks lame duck session that Congress goes back to finish the business at hand, we could see, unfortunately, more layoffs. So that is something SACE is strongly supportive of, and I know there are many groups perhaps on this call that are also working. I did want to point out as an individual, we do have a take action on our homepage, cleanenergy.org, under Hot Topics, where you can click and send a letter to your congressmen and senators advocating that they help extend this. You may also reach out to me if as a business or an organization you would like to sign on to a congressional letter. We will be delivering letters when we go to meet with individual state delegation members from the Southeast up in Washington, D.C. next week. So if you have questions, if you would like to sign on to a letter as an organization or business, please reach out to me. And otherwise, if you would like to just sign as a private citizen, I certainly encourage you to do that as well. And last slide here, Erin, if you can go to one thing. I just want to jump back sort of at the very end here for a moment to some state policy in the region. There has been talk nationally about repealing state renewable energy policies around the country. And the reason I just wanted to focus for just a minute here on North Carolina is obviously North Carolina is the only Southeastern state with a renewable energy and renewable energy and efficiency portfolio standard, so clearly that would make us a candidate on the list. It's very hard to say, though. my crystal ball is cloudy for a variety of factors. It's hard to know how the new legislature is going to act. There will be approximately 50 new legislators out of 170 total. So with approximately a third new members in the body, it's hard to predict anything, really. It is possible, and we hope likely, that if bills are introduced to roll back the RES here, that they will fail to gain traction. That has happened in the last legislative cycle, and so we hopefully will not see positive action to repeal that here in the Southeast, but I would absolutely ask people to remain vigilant and keep watching, because it would certainly be a blow to the manufacturing and the installation and development in our region if we take a step backwards like that. And we are now at 40 minutes, so there's really not time to dive into each state in the region. Obviously, I've gone through 10 states already from a congressional level, and there are certainly policy implications for energy and climate in all of the different states, but we will absolutely continue to blog on these topics. There will be webinars in the new year, renewable energy generation, energy efficiency gains, and programs. So I please welcome and encourage you to join these as they are announced, and we'll go in more depth by issues and sometimes by states. So with that, I will turn to our questions page, Erin, and I welcome any questions we have. There is my contact information, so you are more than welcome to reach me offline at the end of this webinar as well, but I am happy to take questions specific to the flood of information I have just put before you.
Okay, Jen, we do have a few questions here. I'm just going to roll right through.
Sure.
Are any of the Southeast delegation's members factors in congressional energy committees?
Yes, that's an excellent question, and one that I should have highlighted as I was moving through it. What I can do, of course, without predicting the future, I can tell you who the members are in this current Congress. They probably will not change, but we will not know that for certain. In the Senate side, on the Energy and Natural Resources Committee, we have two. We just have one now. We do have Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee. Formerly, we had Richard Burr of North Carolina, but he has since shifted from that committee. So we do have a single voice on the Energy and Natural Resources Committee from the Southeast, and then from the Environment and Public Works Committee, because that one is one that often has more climate implications. Energy, of course, is public land, forest, water, and power and energy. But Environment and Public Works, we have also just one now, and that number has changed. Two. We have Jeff Sessions of Alabama, and we have Lamar Alexander of Tennessee. So again, watch this space, because that could shift or change in the new Congress. Those are for the Senate side. On the House side, the House Energy and Commerce Committee is the committee of jurisdiction for most things that are energy related. There are a number of members. I'll just sort of quickly name them off. Cliff Stearns from Florida, although, as I said, he lost in the primary and will not be returning to Congress. Sue Myrick of North Carolina, again, not returning. She retired and will not be returning in the new Congress. Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee, who did win re-election and will be returning. Phil Gingrey of Georgia, also returning. And then in Virginia, Morgan Griffith. So from the Southeast, also Greg Harper of Mississippi. So again, a number on the Republican side. On the Democratic side, on the Energy and Commerce Committee, there are just a couple. We have G.K. Butterfield of North Carolina, and we also have John Barrow of Georgia. Those are right now the only two from the Southeast, and again, that could change.
Okay, another question here. Were there any relevant ballot measures of note in the Southeast?
That is an excellent question. There were no climate and energy specific ballot measures in the Southeast that came up for re-election, or came up for consideration this time. The closest related for that, in Michigan, there was a ballot initiative to increase the renewable energy portfolio standard, which was actually crushingly defeated. But that obviously does not impact our region. And then I don't know of any other. There were certainly ballot measures and amendments that Florida had, if I understand correctly, a 10 to 12 page ballot because there were so many amendments and provisions to consider, but none of them were directly related to energy. And I stand corrected if there are. I focus more on federal than state policy, but there is certainly opportunities in the future for more to come up. And Florida has talked about and flirted with off and on the idea of a renewable energy ballot measure, and the time may come in a new election cycle to try to gain support for that.
Okay. What will the National Ambient Air Quality Standards regulate, and what kind of timeline are we looking at for their implementation?
The National Ambient Air Quality Standards are for particulate matter. Those are for what comes largely from transportation. And those air quality standards will be tightening up how much of this particulate matter being the literally tiny particles that go into the air when fossil fuels are burned and then go into lungs. And again, I don't have a lot of specifics on that. I'm sorry, that is not something I am tracking super closely. It is something that has been proposed for strengthening. We do have national ambient air quality standards right now, but they are not strong enough. Health groups across the board have been urging for them to get stronger, particularly the American Lung Association. They are not strong enough, and the EPA had come forward in the past and said these are not strong enough. They do not protect adequately, especially in young and old people. So.
Okay, thanks, Jen. We have another question here. What will be the major implications for the ozone rule revision?
Well, and then, of course, that's a related ozone rule largely coming from when you have combustion at ground level, that is often called ground level ozone, and when you have pollution that is forming as a result of transportation, certainly contributes to a lot of it, and then also from other forms of carbon combustion. The current ozone rule does need to be revised at least by 2014. There was talk in this year of the ozone rule coming up, no, I'm sorry, that was the end of last year, of the ozone rule coming up for strengthening sort of in a mid-cycle. And EPA was beginning the process of that, and the rule was pulled by the president to not go forward. And there was a lot of outcry and anger about that. And that ozone rule, again, groups like the American Lung Association and others have said that these rules must be tighter. There must be stricter, higher standards of what is allowed to be emitted. And simply by doing that, you will take some of your dirtiest sources out. And so, again, I'm sorry, I don't have more detailed information at my hands on that right now. We certainly have information on our website, and I will be happy to communicate with somebody offline to help find some more information on that.
Okay, great. Thanks, Jen. Here we have another question. We have a lot of questions, by the way.
Okay.
Is there a greater likelihood of Obama taking direct action on climate change since he will not be seeking re-election, or will that likely be seen as unstrategic and controversial for the Democratic Party?
Well, and again, this is 10,000-foot guessing here. The president, of course, cannot create or pass legislation. He depends on Congress to do that. And as I said, we have a closely divided Congress, basically about the same as what we started with. And so It is unlikely that if a Democratic House and a Democratic Senate could not pass a climate bill in 2009 and 2010, it seems close to impossible to imagine that a Republican House and a Democratic Senate will take up the cause. That is not to say that directionally correct legislation may not go forward. As I said, we may see some efforts at moving non-controversial legislation and policies that signal the right direction for curbing carbon emissions and greenhouse gas emissions and increasing clean renewable energy standards, renewable energy sources. That certainly may go through as legislative policies. It is, I think, more likely that the president, my opinion, but I think it is more likely that the president is going to continue to use the tools that he has available, mostly through Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, and the EPA, in order to help promote rules and standards that are carbon and climate friendly. He is not running again, so yes, he can technically speak on the bully pulpit all he wants on these issues. But all the members of the Senate, unless anybody announces that they're going to retire, they will run again. And these are sometimes tough votes when you're talking policy changes like this. So but anything is possible. We had a late endorsement for the president from New York's Mayor Michael Bloomberg, and he specifically cited the need for action on climate change as part of his endorsement. And New York is still flooding today, now from a new nor'easter, not a hurricane, but barely recovered from Hurricane Sandy, and now a nor'easter is causing some flooding. So I think as we continue to see what we have certainly seen this year, the summer of extremes between droughts and wildfires and a derecho extreme weather event, and we're just seeing so many events that the word extreme weather events is almost becoming overused because they're pretty much all extreme now. As we're moving into this, unfortunately, what many are calling a new normal, there may be increasing pressure for action to come, but it is to me hard to see how that action is going to come sort of unilaterally, either from the president or this big sweeping change, you know, until leadership and lawmakers go there and until the public pushes them there. I think we're going to see more of the incremental change that we can. That is not to say we should not be pushing, because it will never change if we're not getting there.
Okay, here's another question. Do you have any ideas to make headway on clean energy in the very red South Carolina?
Well, one thing that I think needs to be watched is, as I mentioned, there has been talk and discussion of a clean energy standard surfacing in the new Congress, and a clean energy standard is only as good or as bad as the details that write it. It sort of goes back to, it depends on what your definition of is. It depends on what your definition of clean energy is. The Southern Alliance for Clean Energy does not consider high-risk energy sources to be clean or fiscally or environmentally sustainable. So there are proponents who would put a clean energy standard either at the state level, like South Carolina, or the federal level, that would include nuclear as part of the definition of clean because it is lower carbon, which is true, but of course there are issues of waste and issues of nuclear proliferation, and we are increasingly seeing in the Southeast problems with water withdrawal and thermal pollution from cooling plants. So there are many issues that would make you question whether nuclear could be considered in a clean energy standard. So I would say first and foremost, it is very important to watch policy mechanisms that are moving like that, because I think once done will be very difficult to undo. And a little sneak preview of coming attractions for the Clean Energy Standard webinar is our internal analysis has shown that depending on how a clean energy standard gets developed, it could essentially mean little to no additional renewable energy in the South, period. It could even cause a slight downtick, just depending on how a standard is written and how numbers and target dates are set. Therefore, putting support behind something that in theory sounds good but is not there could actually harm the efforts. Of course, at state levels, there are important measures, and I know in South Carolina, and I apologize, my details are a little fuzzy, but I know there has been a petition being circulated to encourage, I believe it's to encourage net metering and to encourage additional policies to further solar development, and solar certainly could have a very strong market in solar. The other thing in South Carolina that I would strongly encourage people to get more educated about and to look into, we certainly have resources and we work closely with allies who are supporting this, is North and South Carolina have outstanding offshore and coastal wind energy resources. And South Carolina, we are, I think, weeks away from the opening of a wind drivetrain testing facility in North Charleston, South Carolina. And that is going to be literally a flagship research facility in the world, not just in South Carolina, not just in the Southeast, where large drivetrains, the internal motor at the top of wind turbines for coastal offshore will come and be tested under conditions so that research and development can speed up and go quicker. As a result of that, we are already starting to see in South Carolina more manufacturing and more development that is related to the wind energy industry. If jobs come and if a level of economic development is coming, there will generally be a greater acceptance for not just the production of this clean energy, but the actual installation and generation of this clean energy. So I highly recommend that in South Carolina, in addition to sort of watching the questionable or the bad, to be doing whatever you can at the state level and local level to really support that, particularly if you are along the coast and you can support your city council, your county council in passing resolutions supporting coastal and offshore wind. We, as I said, we have a letter where we are hopefully going to be delivering to Congress in a few days where we are urging extension of the production and investment tax credits because those are so important for continuing to move that along.
Okay, thanks, Jen. We do have quite a few questions left. Do you want to keep going? We're almost to the hour here. So,
are we able to go over the hour? I mean, I'm certainly happy to take questions for a bit longer, and as people need to drop off, they can drop off. And then, as I said, my contact information is there on this final screen, so please feel free to contact me directly afterwards if you have questions or feedback.
Great. Okay, so we'll keep rolling here.
Sure.
When will the appointments to the different departments, Interior, EPA, et cetera, take place, and do we have any influence over these appointments?
Well, your influence would be if you are already largely within an inner circle. So short answer is no. Those are obviously very high-level appointments based on the people who currently staff those positions. They are former governors. They are former senators, usually fairly high up. The appointments can pretty much come at any point in the coming 6 to really possibly even 12 months. For instance, there is an open position. I think it's Treasury. I'm trying to remember. I think it's Treasury. So, I mean, sometimes a position is already open and sits open for a while. So, for instance, that may be a position that gets filled quicker. And as I said, it is not unusual that in an incumbent second term that secretaries leave. It's not an indication that they are any less supportive or committed to the Obama administration. It's just that it's a high-powered, high-pressure job, and 4 years is often enough for people. So we don't have strong signals on exactly when that would occur. And the nomination occurs, and then there is the vetting process and the confirmation process. If anyone on this call, you know, knows people within the administration or knows people that are connected, these come entirely from the Obama administration. They recommendations may come from members of Congress, particularly those in the majority party or in the president's party, I should say. But his administration will make the decisions. We have heard, now this is something that was circulated, I saw in some media coverage in the last week. I have not substantiated it, and I'm not really sure about the sources, but one of the possible appointments to the energy-related post is that we have heard that, that Secretary Chu is interested in leaving, that he is interested in returning back to California, to Berkeley National Labs, and so therefore with Energy Open, a fairly important post there, the current CEO of Duke Energy, Jim Rogers, I have heard his name as a possible name, but only one of several possible names, and I should have had that information in front of me. I do not know. There were five or six names. It was an article from Energy Environment publication, and there were quite a few names listed, but the only one that, that obviously rang a bell, given the Southeast implications of it, was CEO of Duke Energy, which, of course, would provide very interesting implications because that company had just recently and newly merged with Progress Energy, and to lose somebody at the top of the helm obviously could make things challenging there. So I really don't know how much credence to give that rumor. But I would expect that you will see at least nominations for any open posts, certainly by the midpoint of the year, and the confirmation process will probably continue throughout 2013. So it may be until close to this time next year before the president has a fully staffed cabinet. But again, that is the person at the top. That's the person holding the reins and helping to set some of the agenda and priorities. Of course, the Department of Energy will continue moving along. There are very qualified, intelligent, good people working there and in the other departments, and they will continue to move things along. It won't grind to a halt.
Okay, great. Another question here. Were there only two seats that were up for election for PSC race out of the five? When will the next election take place for the remaining seats?
Yes. They run on a rotating cycle, so not all of the commissioners come up at the same time, and I am literally looking this up as we speak. I'm pretty sure that I read that there is one or two, I think it's either two seats come up in 2 years and then one seat after that, or it's one seat come up in 2 years and then two seats after that. So it is a, they are 6-year terms, and it's on a continually staggered cycle. Sort of much like the Senate, you know, you don't reelect the entire Senate at one time. So the two incumbents who were just reelected are now in for 6 years. And I will look this up as I take the next question and then kind of report back. But that is what I remembered reading.
Okay. Do energy advocates plan to reevaluate and or change their messaging to garner enough votes from Democrats and Republicans from the Southeast and Midwest to finally reach closure on energy policies?
Well, I mean, the short answer is I don't know. It's clear to anybody who's paying attention that what was attempted in 2009 didn't work. The bill that did pass the House that did have certainly some good implications for renewable energy efficiency and climate pollution reduction was also fraught with lots of problems. There were many people, including those within the environmental industry, that were not supportive of it. So it didn't have full support either within the chamber of the House or even people who were promoting it or trying to defeat it, and then likewise in the Senate, it couldn't really get off the ground. So I am not clear exactly whether the approach that needs to be is that we are going to go to a more piecemeal approach. For years, the magic bullet, if you will, was a comprehensive climate energy bill, something that was sector-wide and sweeping, economy-wide, and going to address all the ills of society at the same time. And it, the process of 2009 and 2010, in a sense, confirmed that is too tricky and too messy. The holdouts were primarily in the Midwest and the Southeast. Those were the two parts of the country that there was the most heartburn with it for various reasons. Obviously, the Northeast and the Western states, at least the far West, were generally more supportive. So unclear that any level of messaging change would work for something like that, although, as I said, something that is more discreet, and which is why I brought up that concept of a carbon tax, something that literally just taxes carbon. That's still not a simple system. I'm not suggesting that's easy, but a carbon tax at least doesn't have quite as many implications and wrinkles as an economy-wide climate energy cap and trade sector bill. So it remains to be seen whether anybody has an appetite to go back in so soon after the first attempt. I would point out and remind people on this call that prior to Obamacare passing a few years ago, the last attempt at universal health care was in Bill Clinton's first term in 1993-94. So that's how many years elapsed between a first big attempt to push a policy initiative over the finish line and then a revisit. We don't have that long for climate energy. I'm not beginning to propose that we sit and wait for 15, 16 years and then think about trying it again. But a couple of years may have left people frustrated and tired and not sure where to go on this, although I think as climate and clean energy advocates, I think we need to continue pushing for everything that is directionally correct, for all incremental changes that are good are still good, and we should still be pushing for them. And as renewable energy achieves increasingly cost parity with what traditional fuel sources cost, utilities make business decisions. And so it may be that we have our eye on the wrong ball. Maybe instead of increasingly trying to push Congress to use carrots and sticks, maybe we continue to keep our eye there, but then we also actively advocate within the business and development realm. And I don't mean just we SAFE and we the people on this call, but that market forces and leaders continue to push renewable energy as it becomes more cost competitive and as it shows other advantages, and then that may shift the energy paradigm without the need of legislation, although I do believe we are going to need some level of mandatory legislation to get our carbon pollution levels down to an acceptable level so that we don't risk catastrophic climate change from rising temperatures and sea level rise and other factors that would kick in.
Okay, Jen, one last question here. What are your thoughts on the reinstatement of the 1603 cash grant for renewables?
Yes, I'm sorry, that was the, can you say, 1603, is that what you said?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that was a provision of the American Recovery Act, also known as stimulus. I mean, it's been around in various forms, and it was part of, perhaps heard that term, $90 billion in green energy and clean energy. I mean, that included that there was $90 billion that went sort of in a large pot, but it obviously didn't go to, quote, green jobs. It went to a whole host of things, and some of them were these renewable energy block grants. I don't know that we would see significant funding. I mean, I don't know. I'm going out on a limb here because I'm not tracking that program super carefully. I think that unless another large stick comes through, which I've not heard any talk of that, or unless what we end up with is additional sources of revenue through a carbon tax or through restructured tax code, and restructuring the tax code is just something that has been on a lot of people's agendas for a very long time, irrespective of whether it's a carbon tax or climate tax, that could open up some money. I mean, there have been times where some of these different pots of money were gone like the day they opened. Yet I know in Florida there was incentives for efficiency that was tied to the ARRA, the stimulus program, and when people would buy more efficient appliances, they would get a discount on the appliance, and the money was sometimes gone within a day. So clearly there's need, and clearly there's desire and demand for it in the market. The question is, will Congress appropriate the money? And as we steer toward the fiscal cliff, and as we still have sort of spiraling deficits and unbalanced budgets, it is hard to see where Congress is going to make that a priority. Of course, with slashed military spending, if these long-term wars draw to a close, obviously that will free up some level of money, but there are lots of other programs waiting as well. So crystal ball is a little too cloudy to see there.
Okay, thanks, Jen.
Sorry I'm a little vague on some of these. I'm really happy to help people research some of these questions, but it was hard to be an expert at all levels on all these different policy questions, but I'm happy to work with people and kind of dig around more as some of these things start to play out.
Great. Thank you, Jen. And thanks, everybody, for attending today and for all your thoughtful questions and comments. We are very excited about our monthly webinar series, and we hope you'll join us again. I just wanted to also remind you that our fall membership campaign ends tomorrow, so if you haven't already, I hope you'll consider joining SACE today through the end of tomorrow. We are offering a discounted $5 membership and a clean energy tote bag as a token of our appreciation for your commitment to a clean energy future. So please check it out on our website, cleanenergy.org, for more information. And this entire presentation and recording of today's webinar will be posted on our website via our webinar archive page. Thanks, everybody, and have a great rest of your day.
Thank you.